Welcome to the Emerging Minds Families Podcast.
Hi, I'm Nadia Rossi, and you're listening to an Emerging Minds Families Podcast. We would like to pay respect to the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is recorded, the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We also pay respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, their ancestors and elders past, present and emerging from the different First Nations across Australia. In today's episode, we will be discussing the complex topic of child removal, child protection and reunification. If you feel this topic may bring up difficult feelings for you, perhaps give this week a miss or join us next fortnight, or you can find resources for support in our show notes. When stigma happens to our families, it can be really hard to know how to respond. But there are many ways that families can and do respond to stigma, discrimination and injustice to hold on to their family's dignity and support their children's well-being. This podcast is part of a series where we explore some of the ways families do this. Maybe you will connect with some of their stories and skills, or maybe they will spark some ideas for facing stigma in your own family. In this episode, my co-host, Alicia Ranford, is talking with Sam Carpenter and Catherine Flavel. Sam is the Senior Manager and Catherine the Senior Practitioner at Centrecare's Unify Reunification Services. They are here to talk about parents working towards reunification and what it can be like for parents and children who have been separated by child protection, including the shame and stigma they can experience.
Welcome, Sam and Kathy. It's great to speak with you today. I wondered if we could start by hearing a little bit about you and the families that you work with. Kathy, I wondered if you wanted to kickstart us off today.
Thank you. So I've been working in a reunification program for, I've almost lost count, I think it's about 8.5 years. And before that, I worked as a family and relationship counsellor. I really, really believe in this work. I believe that children need to be with their families if it's safe. It's a bit of a passion of mine, and I've worked in this program firstly as an on-the-ground caseworker and then as a senior practitioner, and now I'm more in the therapeutic role.
Fantastic. And Sam?
Yeah, hi, my name's Sam. So I've been working at Centrecare for about 6 years now, and I've worked in the child protection, I guess in the field of child protection for, I don't know, probably about 25 years now, most of my, all of my working life, really. So it's always been, part of what I do and a passion of mine. But since working at Centrecare, I've really feel like I've found the way that I like to work and the way that I think is really useful for families. So that the service that we both work at is called Unify. We're a reunification service, which for people that don't know what that is, that's a term that we use in child protection for after a child is removed, the process of hopefully them returning to live with their family again. Sometimes that's successful and sometimes it isn't. And we are not the decision makers in that regard. Obviously there's a government party involved, that's DCP. Department for Child Protection. So they are both the funders of our service and also the decision makers generally for children. When we work with children, we work with a whole range of different families and situations. We work with children and young people who have just been removed from their family and might be on a short-term court order or might be just not even on a court order at all. And we also work with children and young people who have been in care for a really long time and who may not have experienced, you know, safety and stability in care, might be coming back home to their parent, in some cases without the approval of DCP and in some cases where DCP have decided that's probably the best option for them. So the focus of our service really is working with parents. Parents are our main client, and working towards that parent, building their parenting skills, building their parenting knowledge, understanding of themselves and their children so that they can parent safely again, which is really important for us to be able to do that, and it's a privilege to be able to do that as well, and it's great that we have a government decision maker involved because that means that we can really focus on what a parent needs to meet their goals.
And I'm imagining that it's what the parents and children need to meet their goals.
Yeah, so I guess there's lots of different ways of looking at child protection and lots of different strong opinions about it. There's often this kind of, a competitive dynamic between being child-focused and being parent-focused. We kind of see them as the same thing. When you're focusing on a parent, you are actually focusing on what a child needs. And if you're unable to work respectfully with a parent and not able to give them what they need, then ultimately that's cutting to the core of the child's identity and you know, the meaning that they make about themselves in the world. I guess the way we look at the term child-focused is that being parent-focused is part of that.
Thanks, Sam. That's a really lovely way to be thinking about this. What are some of the things you notice about the parents that you interact with during your working day?
I think the most important thing, the most central topic to parents and their children being removed and the child protection system is trauma, and particularly intergenerational trauma is really central to this. That's, I would say, when I talk to people about what we do, I would say that's our core business, is responding to intergenerational trauma. And when we deal with families who have experienced trauma in their lives, one of the things that we notice is that people that experience trauma often don't experience it just once. They often need to experience it or have to experience it again and again and again. And for many people with trauma, I think sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between the past and the present. So child removal itself is a trauma. People who have their children removed, by and large, are people that have experienced intergenerational trauma. I'd say almost 100% of the people that we work with have experienced trauma in their own lives, generally in their own childhood. And when you have those experiences in your life and then you experience a child being removed, often that feels very, very similar to the trauma that you may have experienced in the past. And people that have had those experiences of trauma often have what we call creative adaptions, so ways that they have learnt to keep themselves safe in the world that were really effective for people in childhood or at the time when they experienced that trauma, but might not be serving them so well now or in the present. So that's one of the things that we come across a lot. And often what I say is our main client is not necessarily the parent as an adult, but that parent as a child. The other thing that we notice about our work is about parenting identity. So parenting is not like a job. It's not like going and working at Bunnings or whatever. It's actually something that really, when people become a parent, that's actually part of who they are. They become, that's part of their identity. And so being a good parent obviously is an important thing for all of us who are parents, and if we're not a good parent, what does that say about us? And so when people have children removed, particularly people who have had their own childhood trauma, you know, for whom being a good parent is extra, extra important, that is actually cuts to the core of who they are. And I think so because of that, so you know, that their self-worth, their purpose in life, all is impacted by child removal. And I think therefore shame and stigma are some of the most important themes that we come across in our work with families.
Yes, that's a good reminder, isn't it? And when we talk about shame and stigma, I'm certain there's probably a lot of people listening today who have perhaps preconceived ideas about families who've had their children removed. What might those preconceptions miss, and what might people not know about the families that you support?
A really important thing that I think about 100% of the families that I work with, and I've been doing this for many, many years now, is that I have never, ever met a parent that does not love their child. I have never, ever met a child that does not love their parent. But I have met many families, many parents and many children that are doing it really, really tough. That things like poverty, homelessness, not having enough resources, being misunderstood, being judged instead of people thinking about the pain that they're feeling and coming alongside them and thinking about what resources they might need and what help they might need. These are the things that people may not know about these families, that these families that we work with work so hard. Parents turn up and feel uncomfortable. for the love of their children. And it's such a privilege for me to go in and sit in these family homes, and sometimes not in family homes because they don't even have them, and to say, how can we help you? What is your dream? And their dream is not million-dollar castles or overseas holidays. It's to be with their children.
Mm.
And I wonder if people can see that, yeah, from the outside.
And to think about all those external factors that have contributed to them being where they are and experiencing what they are in that moment.
Yes. And, you know, I believe, truly believe, that people do the best they can with the resources they have and the knowledge that they have at the time. When we can understand that and come alongside them and support them, they can learn new ways of being. They can work towards supporting their children.
Absolutely. And Sam, you mentioned before about stigma and shame. Could you explain to our listeners what is stigma and what kinds of stigma are the families you work with facing?
The textbook definition of stigma is really the key term is having a single story to describe someone. And so that single story can sometimes mean that we ignore all of the depth of experience that a person might have, or all of the other things that might be going on for that person. When we think about stigma in child protection, I think one of the things probably the most important to bear in mind is that child protection is a government. It's a system that is influenced by politics. And if you go and ask the majority of people on the street, like if you were to walk out on the street today and say, hey, what do you think about people who abuse their children? Most of them probably would say, well, they deserve to have their rights taken away, or they deserve to have their children removed and never returned. And that's what kind of, I guess, the average voter thinks, and that's what generally the government then is responding to in how they set policy and how they treat those people. But that is a single story, and that single story causes stigma, and it causes the parents that we work with to have a lot of their good intent and their resilience that we see a lot. You know, I think that's a really key term that we use a lot is resilience. Many parents that we work with have survived things that we couldn't even imagine surviving. And to be that resilient and still be there and show up for your kids and be available and want to be the best parent that you can. And for many, they are excellent, excellent parents too. But some stuff has got in the way, and that story gets ignored when we think about how the public would perceive and even how the government might perceive parents who have their children removed.
And I think for me too, I think that stigma actually does not serve children. That stigma about parents not deserving to get their children back actually comes in the way of children having loving parents. So while there is a temptation, or it's sort of understandable, we all want to protect children, we all want what's best for children, and it's sort of understandable that we might not show generosity to their parents. But I think when we don't do that, when we don't open up and think about all of the richness of their stories and look for their strengths and their resilience, we do not serve children. We do not serve children at all.
For our listeners today who might not understand what reunification means, could you explain a little bit about that?
So reunification, I mean, it's a term used by the system. That in other states, they use other terms like restoration. But generally, it means the process of exploring the option of a child returning back home after being removed.
And is it always about a child going home? Is that the only type of reunification that you work with?
Yeah, in a strict sense, that is the case. That's what we're funded to provide a service while the department is making a decision about whether a child returns home. And there would be some reunification services that would probably finish at the point that that decision is made, particularly if the decision is that the child goes into long-term care. And in many cases, parents will want to stop work at that point as well, because it's an extremely traumatising, painful kind of situation, and sometimes people aren't up for continuing to work on themselves after that. But if they are up for continuing to work with us, we will certainly continue to work with families because we know that that work's always going to be valuable for that child. A person's identity is strongly linked with their family, and you know, children need parents to be the best parents they can be no matter where they're living.
And we give all children the chance. That's the important thing. We give all children the chance to go home by working with their parents. And if parents can't make those changes within the time frames that the government agency decides, then the work is still valuable, because then if those children do come home later, which many children do self-place, then the parents are more able to be there for them, because the children's identity, who they are, the family that they were born into, matters for the rest of their lives, no matter where they live. This is important, and this is important when they have children.
When we think about stigma in the systems with which our daily lives function, like school system, the health and legal system, and even the child protection system, can you talk a little bit more about the way stigma can show up in the lives of the families you work with?
Yeah, so I guess I kind of alluded to it before, but all of those systems that you talk about, they're all political systems. They're all things that are influenced by the government of the day, by voters, by, you know, what we think people will, the majority of people think is okay. And I think that certainly leads to those systems sometimes being stigmatizing. I talked before about if you were to ask the majority of people on the street what they think of parents who abuse their kids, I guess the majority of people would give answers that reflect that they hold stigma about that population. The other thing I think to note about that is that's often a gendered thing too. I think if we were to ask people about what they think about mums who abuse their children, generally their answer would be very different to what they would say about dads who abuse their children. And I think we see that play out as well in the child protection system. Mums and dads, rightly or wrongly, are treated very differently in the system. The other thing about that is it's cultural, so it's defined by the dominant culture. And we have a huge problem all over the country of the over-representation of Aboriginal children in our child protection system and in other systems too, like the justice system. Which is something that I think the majority of people, everyone that works in the system, will acknowledge that is a huge problem that we need to address. That is not okay. But why haven't we been able to address that? I think that's about stigma. And that's about the way dominant culture or political systems have a particular way of looking at what is safe and what is not safe. And that's a culturally defined idea. So I think that's what kind of causes the systemic racism that we do experience in the system.
I think it's really important to note there's so much pressure on teachers and health professionals and those systems to, with their mandatory reporters, you know, there's a lot of pressure and accountability on those people that work in those systems that can sometimes overshadow being able to sit and look at the bigger picture. And when we look at the bigger picture, then we can see what resources are missing and bring those resources in to be able to really help the parents. I feel like the people that work in those systems really want to do that, but they're under just so much pressure to be accountable for reporting that it's really hard for them. But when you can look at the little person in your classroom and think about how could this child's life change if we could help mum and dad a little bit more, or mum a little bit more, so that they could stay home, so that they could be safe, I think that's a good way to think about it too.
What are the effects of stigma the families you work with talk to you about?
I think sometimes the effects of stigma on families that we work with, sometimes it almost comes in the way and denies them the ability to lean into help that is available, because there's a bit of a paradox, I guess, that when people feel shamed by the behaviour that might have led to child removal and the behaviour that might have led to children not being safe, they feel like that might impact on their chance to get their child back. And so that also impacts their ability to open up and receive the help that they need. And so it's really tricky when you work with these families. Like, there's a real difference between, or the way that I think about it, there's a real difference between accountability for their behaviour and really saturating people with responsibility and shame, because when we do that, we limit their capacity to change and grow. So it's a really delicate balance to hold people in that way, that you did the best you could at the time with the resources that you had, but that didn't really work out so well. So how can we go back and think about that in a different way?
I guess the way the system sometimes operates, what it demands of parents in this situation is several things, that they acknowledge that harm has occurred, that they acknowledge and take responsibility for their role in the harm, and that they then take some actions to demonstrate change. They're kind of the three things that the system usually expects parents to be able to demonstrate. But it usually asks that of them very, very quickly after what's been quite a traumatic event for them. And that's really difficult for people to do, particularly when they don't feel that their experience of trauma has been validated or that they have had empathy about what they have been through. And I guess what we talk about when we talk about these situations, the idea of child focus or the child's rights or the child's voice, that's usually seen as a bit of a slam dunk argument, that no one can argue with that, the importance of those things. And so if the parent is not seen to be child focused in the way they talk about the experiences that they've had, that generally means that they're not viewed favourably in terms of having their children returned. What I think we see is that there's actually an important step to take before you ask parents to do that, and that's to validate and acknowledge the experiences that they have had, and to acknowledge what Kathy said, that they've actually done the best that they could with the resources available to them. And so rather than looking at that parent as a person, probably what we need to be looking at first is what resources did they have available to them at the time, and what resources can we make available to them now.
And as you said, that stigma doesn't get in the way of them leaning in to get support to reach their goals of reunification or getting the support that they require.
That's right. The other thing that's really important to us in our work that's not necessarily always seen as positive is that we don't assess. So when we go into work with a family, we often get asked, what's your assessment of this parent's capacity? And we really intentionally, and we have to hold on quite strongly to this principle, have to say, that's not our job. We're not there to assess, because when we do, we're actually becoming then a barrier to them reaching out and receiving the support that they need to process their trauma, to make the changes that they need, and to have someone on their side, which is something that we've always often heard from parents as being really important.
Yeah, and I think because we do take that stance, parents do lean into our support, and we can go to places that they wouldn't necessarily go if we were doing assessments, and that's where the real magic happens. That's where the real change happens. And that doesn't mean that we don't work with the department and inform them of our observations so that they can make their assessments. But that's always done with total transparency of the parent, unless there is a risk to a child, that by doing that we would put a child at risk. We would never do that. Of course we see the risk, but we would encourage parents to be able to sit with uncomfortable feelings and bring forward information to the department and support them to do that, because that's part of their healing. And that, I think, is really important.
And within those uncomfortable feelings that you speak about, can we talk about shame? And in your experience, is shame helpful or harmful for families who are going through tough times and facing stigma?
I feel like the whole range of human emotions are there for a reason. So I think a little bit of shame, if it is supported with empathy, can be useful, but we don't want parents to drown in it, because I think a way that I think about shame is that when we feel shame, we can sometimes feel like we're a bad person. And how do you grow and learn and do things differently if you're just fundamentally bad? That's really, really hard. Mm. Whereas if parents can understand that, you know, they were born a beautiful, innocent little baby once, and then they had some really tough stuff that happened to them, that they developed these creative adaptations to survive, and that might have caused them to act in a way that maybe served them when they were a child, but it doesn't serve them now as a parent. And so when we can separate out the behaviour, when we can say, you were born a good person once, but you did this thing that didn't align with your values, it didn't serve your child, it didn't serve who you wanted to be as a parent, then we sort of shift shame to guilt. It's more about the behaviour. And that is where we have this beautiful growth environment that we can change. You know, I'm a good parent and I'm a good person that did it, something that hurt my child, and I don't ever want to do that again. And, you know, how amazing for children not to have, you know, if you think about children's identity, if their parent is bad and they come from that parent, what does that mean for them? Whereas if they are exposed to this idea that my parent did the best that they could at the time, but it didn't work out so well and they're working really hard, but, you know, my parent is a good person that made a mistake and now fixing it, what does that mean for that child? What template does that give them? That I'm a good person too and I can make good choices. It's just so much better. It's just so much healthier. It's just such an environment for healing and growth and to break that intergenerational cycle.
And to lead to such better outcomes for children.
Yes, to lead to such better outcomes for children. It doesn't have to be picture perfect. It has to be safe and it's so worth it.
And what are some of the ways you have seen parents responding to the shame and stigma they experience?
I'm thinking about a particular example. Lots of people flood to me actually when I think about this. And I think the first automatic response, and we talk a lot about sometimes when we're triggered, we sort of have a backseat driver, we sort of have an automatic default that we go to in behaviour. And I think often it's a self-protection thing. We think about it like a bit of like a shame shield. So that's often projection, that's often I didn't do anything wrong. And when we understand that and can sit alongside that and try and show empathy, then people have the power to put that down and to be able to take accountability and to think about, oh, this feels really bad. This feels really bad. I feel really bad that I did this thing. And we can sit alongside them and they don't have to sit in that alone, because people can do really hard things if they don't have to do it on their own. And shame is so isolating. They feel like they're on their own. So when we can come alongside and say, yeah, that does feel really bad, hey? That does feel really bad. And you can tolerate this feeling so that you can make a better choice and live a better life and be the parent you always dreamed to be.
And to not feel that isolation, I think that's something that strikes me from what you've said, is that it can be so isolating, and to not feel that isolation anymore must be really empowering.
It's so empowering. And then that, when they don't feel like they're on their own, parents can then lean into the supports that they desperately need, you know. But it's hard for all of us, hey, to do stuff on our own. It's so much. And we use the phrase a lot in our program that we walk alongside the families that we work with. We walk alongside children. We walk alongside parents. Sometimes we, towards the end of our intervention, we even walk a step behind. But we try not to walk too much in front of them, because that's disempowering.
And what about children and young people? What are some of the ways you've seen children respond to the shame and stigma that they have experienced?
We worked with a family where three little children were returned to their dad, and it was a lot of work. They were in foster care, and there were some care concerns in the foster care placement, and so they were. So then DCP looked again and decided, oh, maybe Dad has made the changes. And I remember going out and being in this home, and this little girl came up to me and said, "Why are you still here?" And I said, "Well, we're here to make sure that you feel safe coming home with your daddy." And she was like, "I'm safe with my daddy. And, you know, the experience that I had, the meaning that I took from this interaction was that she really needed us to be on her side and to be on Dad's side. Like, she didn't need the stigma that her daddy wasn't safe. She needed the opposite, actually. She needed us to believe in her dad and to believe in her and to believe in her family. And to believe, you know, and not blindly believe, of course we see risk, but we don't want that stigma to get in the way of her being able to trust her dad anymore, you know. We did a lot of work to support Dad to be able to say what happened before you were removed was not okay and you didn't feel safe. And these are the things that I've done now so that you can be safe. But things are different now to help her believe that. I think that's the greatest gift for her to feel like, yep, they understand. My dad understands that was not okay and he's changed and things are different now and I can feel safe. Because it's a big leap of faith. It's, you know, a big thing for kids to come back. And so they need a sort of wrap around that, not coming the way of that.
I mean, one of the things that we talk about a little bit is mistakes of meaning and blame. So for children that have been through these sorts of experiences, it's often hard for them to see the whole dynamic of what's going on, and often for a child their kind of natural response to that is to blame themselves or to say, you know, this happened because of something I did or because of who I am. And so being able to correct those is an important way of helping children to be able to stand up to, the stigma and shame of being removed from your family, of being in care. What we think is one of the most important ways of doing that is through the parent telling that narrative and telling it in a child-friendly way, of course. You know, they need to be at a point where they're not blaming everyone else for that. But that is one of the most healing ways of a child being able to overcome that stigma and shame is hearing the story of their relationship with their parent from their parent's point of view, and then all of those other things obviously happening as well. You know, the system around being able to reassure that child that things have changed, mum or dad are safe now. You know, kids are pretty intuitive and they can tell if we don't really think that, and they can certainly tell when the department is still involved and when they're still visiting a lot and when they're visiting them at school to see them without their parent, things like that really kind of cut across that message of things have changed, you're safe now, and that then can become a little bit self-fulfilling. So it can mean that, you know, children do feel unsafe even when maybe they're not. Those are really important things as well, correcting those mistakes of meaning and reassuring the child that they are, if indeed they are safe, making sure that that message is given by everyone.
And really helping them to make meaning of the whole experience that they've gone through. Yeah. It sounds like that's very important as well.
You know, this family, the really magical thing was that this little girl could say, I was scared, Daddy. I was scared. And that he could say, I know you were. I'm sorry. I never want you to be scared again. You know, not dismissing her fear. That's how we work, to tell the whole story, not just the good bits, the whole story, and then to repair that
what I'm hearing from our whole conversation today is that working with parents to overcome that shame and stigma and to allow them to have those conversations with their children through this reunification process really helps the child to move through their own experience, make meaning, and help this family come back together without either of them feeling the shame and stigma that they did previously.
That, you know, as the parent, yeah, the child can feel, I love my parent, they love me. This was really hard. We both lost out. The parents lost out on having time with us. We lost time having time with our parents. But we can do hard things. We can work this out. We can make this better. This does not have to be our whole story. And we come back to that, you know, the danger of the single story. Stories have so much richness to them, the good, the bad, the resilience, the disappointment. When children can experience alongside their parents, when they can experience that, then, you know, that makes for real, really rich family identities that go on generation after generation, and particularly with our Aboriginal families. You know, the importance of that identity. You think about colonisation and that story. We don't want to keep doing that. We don't want to keep doing that. We want to hear from them how they think they can come together and heal.
And unfortunately, how we approach keeping children safe often ends up placing a lot of blame and pressure on parents and carers and individual families rather than addressing those kinds of forces that mean families are going through tough times in the first place. What role do others have in standing alongside the families you work with to reduce their shame and stigma?
I feel like it starts with, if we think about stigma and the single story, I feel like the antidote might have something to do with people, just the general public, opening their hearts, opening their minds, thinking about things from a really broad lens, and thinking about what resources might be helpful, how can they help in a small way. Rather than being focused on the deficit, being able to sit with the uncomfortable feelings that come up for us when we see a child that might be doing it really tough and wanting to blame their parents, thinking about, is there an opportunity for me to help here? Even if it's in a small way. Is there an opportunity to give a kind word to a parent that comes in that might look like they're doing it really tough, rather than feeling uncomfortable and getting lost in our own discomfort and walking to the other side of the room? You know, to be curious about what's happening for that family. Always holding on to our curiosity rather than focusing on deficit, focusing on an opportunity to come alongside. Saying anything is better than saying nothing. Walking alongside and starting up a conversation, you know. Susie's really good on the slippery dip. Just something that you would say to somebody that isn't doing it tough. Just opening up lines of communication, you know. I noticed that Jenny and Susie both like that swing. They both want to be on that swing at the same time, and really finding moments of connection and sameness rather than how are we different. I think stigma and shame really breeds an us and them sort of mentality, where to remember we are all parents. We have all struggled getting our children off the slippery dip and home when for dinner. And to connect on those moments of sameness.
That's a beautiful thing for all of our listeners to remember and can be taken across so many different scenarios. And I love that finding connection of sameness. I think that's something we can all remember to do. You both obviously work in a fairly specialised service. From your years of experience, what advice would you have for parents who are feeling shame and stigma about what's happened or is going on in their lives?
Yeah, it's a tricky one to answer because we can only answer it from the point of view of the work that we do. But I think the answer is probably captured in some of the ways that we work. And one of the most important things is to have empathy for yourself, to know within yourself that you have done your best, and you have done your best with the resources that are available to you at the time. And remembering that is a way of actually, I guess, freeing yourself to actually look at doing things differently, to understand that trauma works in really interesting ways, and it can make you make decisions that seem like they are right at the time, because when you were a child, that probably was the only way of surviving, was to behave in that way. But as you get older, you do sometimes need to adapt different ways of being in the world. I think they're important things to know, but to also to know that you're not alone. I think of the other important fact is definitely there are so many people going through this, so you're not alone. And it is possible to get help, and it is possible to heal from past trauma. It can seem like an insurmountable thing, like a massive mountain that's almost impossible to climb, but it's not. There is help available. And that might look like firstly talking to your GP, getting a mental health care plan, exploring what some of the therapeutic services are in your area. They're not all costly. Centrecare has a family and relationship counselling service that we often refer families to. That is low cost or free. And obviously there are some, not that many, but there are some therapists that bulk bill. Just getting out there and believing that there is something out there for you if you look hard enough. And starting with your GP is a good place to start.
In your experience with the families that you work with, what do you think they'd want our listeners to know today about child protection and the feelings of shame and stigma?
We recently made a video, actually, of one of the families that we work with, and she wanted to tell her story because she had worked really hard and her children, or her little one, was returned to her. And the thing that she said was that, when I first met you, I hated you. I didn't want you here. I didn't think that you had anything to offer me. I thought some of the things that you said were rubbish. This is not a direct quote, but, and she said, when I met you, this is a direct quote, my heart was broken. There was no light at the end of the tunnel for me. And she said, now I've had so many aha moments, and I realized the things that I hated that happened to me as a child, I had repeated, but I just didn't realize that. And she said, now there's nothing but light at the end of that tunnel for me.
Isn't that beautiful? Thank you for sharing that with us. And thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. It has been such a beautiful insight for our listeners about the effects of stigma and shame and what they can have on children and families who are navigating child protection. And you've also provided some really wonderful ways that we can support those who may be feeling the effects of stigma and shame. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you would like to keep up to date with our latest conversations, we'd love it if you like and subscribe to our Emerging Minds Families podcast channel. You can also find us on Instagram at Emerging Minds AU or on Facebook at Emerging Minds Families. You have been listening to an Emerging Minds Families podcast. If anything spoken about in today's episode has been distressing for you, or you find yourself struggling, please reach out for help. You can call Lifeline on 131114, or we'll have more resources for support in our show notes.
Visit our website at www.emergingminds.com.au/families for a wide range of free information and resources to help support child and family mental health. Emerging Minds leads the National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health. The National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health and Aged Care under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Programme.